and putting pressure on them. So who's screening and surveilling those doing the screening and surveilling? So we have to get out of here. Thank you again, Professor Chajua, for your time. I'm sure we will talk to you again soon. Glad you're feeling better. And we will talk to you later.
Hey, bro.
Good. Thank you for having me.
So as we wrap up this show, we hope that it's been informative. We had a lot of people texting and calling. We couldn't open both lines up, but it seems to have gone well. As my predecessor, our predecessor, Mr. John Lee Johnson, used to say, stay out of trouble. But as Paul Muth, the late, great John Lewis, and myself say, get in the right kind of trouble. Peace and much love to you.
Don't say late, great so close to my name.
Okay.
Higher Ground.
Yes, indeed.
Heard a rendition of that last night at the Folk and Roots Festival by the Strings of Soul. What are they called?
Oh,
Nikki Brown.
Uh-huh.
It was awesome. I was just watching it from home. They screened about 7.5 hours of video from the Rose Bowl, including her set. I got back out after that, actually, though. This morning, Son Monarcos, the sound of the monarchs, something like that. I think it's a play on words, actually, in Spanish, and my Spanish isn't good enough to perceive that. So, that was an amazing show. I hope you didn't just tune in for me. You should tune in for Higher Ground as well. My name is Paul Muth. This is the show News from Neptune. I call it the radio edit for some reasons that go back historically. I've got something on the border from Carmen, from Miss Professor Bastillo, I'll call him, since I'm having a cameo. He's in Taiwan. Got something from Democracy Now! From yesterday and the expanded version. I edited it together. Guy from Public Citizens talking about the machinations of Moderna, particularly. Pfizer's no better, really, as far as vaccine production. Pretty astonishing stuff in it, actually. And there's more that isn't even said in it, so that's astonishing. A piece from Natasha Lenart that I haven't heard yet, but she's great with The Intercept. She's going to talk about the differential punishment of, let's say, the January 6th rioters, whatever they were, stormers of the Capitol, die Storm. And a guy in Tallahassee who just said that he thought that there should be some self-protection of the community, including with guns, which is a legal carry state, too. So she's going to unpack that at the very end. That kind of resonates. Speaking of technology and surveillance, the gunshot surveillance system in Chicago has been studied finally, and it is useless. I can't remember the source on that. I think maybe the Invisible Institute out of Chicago might have had something to do with it. They're a good group. They were fundamental in getting the one of the police killings that happened under Rahm Emanuel released, which showed that it was pretty much a summary execution and by a guy that drove up and 40 seconds later started shooting a guy who was walking away. There's so many of these people that the names blend together. I'm sorry, I can't remember to say his name, as the expression goes. Okay. Bastillo on the border, Amy Goodman. And that is a piece, like I said, on the vaccine situation. Got her Breaking the Soundberry essay, which is about police killings, curiously enough. There's a lot of stuff to cover, and she's probably mounting her trip to Glasgow. I guess she's going to go cover it. I haven't heard her refer to it yet. I hope they're financially well enough off that she can mount a trip there. I'm sure she could get some speaking engagements in the UK to pay the freight a little bit, I suppose, since she has a big audience there as well. Thanks you for tuning in. Thank you for supporting WEFT. We still are sort of low-key asking for your donations. I still got to get my old rides into the mix. Okay, well, Los Monarcos from Chicago are doing a children's workshop this morning, and that should be on Rose Bowl TV, so you could tune and watch that at the same time. They're going to do some Aztec dances, which is pretty intriguing because it's not like the music they play. They have another set this evening as well. Anyway, without further ado, I say that a lot. Here's Amy Goodman's essay, Breaking the Sound Barrier.
An epidemic within the pandemic, police killings of African American men. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. While the pandemic slows throughout the United States, at least among the vaccinated, another deadly epidemic persists unchecked: police killings of men of color. A Washington Post online database reports 7,216 people killed by police since 2015, with 914 killed so far this year. African Americans are 2 to 3 times more likely than whites to be killed by police. A movement is growing to hold these violent officers accountable. Progress is being made, as demonstrated by developments in the cases of Ahmaud Arbery, Roger Green, and Elijah McClain. Nothing will bring them back, but accountability may prevent future deaths at the hands of police. In his book, The Condemnation of Blackness, Khalil Gibran Muhammad writes, "There's an arc of history that connects lynching's past to policing's present," unquote. As devastatingly documented at the Legacy Museum and Memorial in Montgomery, Alabama, lynching was central to terrorizing the African-American population following emancipation from slavery. Ahmaud Arbery's violent death on February 23, 2020, caught on video by one of the accused perpetrators, had all the hallmarks of those lynchings from a century ago. On that sunny Sunday afternoon in the suburbs of Brunswick, Georgia, Gregory McMichael and his son Travis saw Arbery jogging, grabbed guns, and pursued him in a pickup truck. Their neighbor, William Roddy Bryan, joined the pursuit in his own truck, recording the video on a cell phone. The father-son team claimed they were attempting a citizen's arrest of Ahmaud Arbery, who rightly resisted. Travis McMichael fired 2 shots, killing Ahmaud. The elder McMichael was a former Glynn County police officer and investigator for the Brunswick Judicial Circuit prosecutor, Jackie Johnson. She was recently indicted for directing police not to arrest Travis McMichael and then steering the case to a sympathetic prosecutor. It was a third prosecutor, after the video evidence became public, who ultimately filed the murder charges against the McMichaels and Bryan. Jury selection is currently underway in their trial. In Louisiana, officers in a notoriously violent state police division known as Troop F engaged in a high-speed pursuit of 49-year-old African-American motorist Ronald Green on May 10, 2019. Police reported he died after crashing into a tree. They later said he struggled with them and that he died on the way to the hospital. More than 2 years later, the Associated Press published shocking police body camera footage of the encounter that painted a drastically different picture.
I'm so scared. I'm just scared. Get out of the hospital. I'm driving me, Chris. I'm scared.
I'm your brother. I'm scared. Green was pleading as police brutally beat, tased, and dragged him while shouting threats and expletives at him. Not long after, he was dead. In a remarkable development, an African-American Louisiana State Trooper, Carl Cavalier, went to the press last June, releasing notes from the officer who investigated the death. That officer had recommended at least one of the troopers involved be arrested and noted that senior state trooper commanders intervened to block any arrests. Carl Cavalier, the whistleblower, has been suspended and reportedly has been fired, although the state police say he's still employed. As Cavalier told a Baton Rouge TV reporter,
we still have murderers in my eyes on the job.
Federal prosecutors are investigating the possible cover-up, reportedly going up the chain of command. Elijah McClain was violently arrested by police in Aurora, Colorado, on August 24, 2019. He was walking home from a convenience store when police stopped him and quickly escalated the encounter. Police tackled him. As Elijah said, I can't breathe, please. He pleaded, I'm an introvert, I'm different.
I don't even kill flies. I don't eat meat.
I don't even kill flies. I don't eat meat. I'm a vegetarian. An emergency medical technician injected Elijah with a massive dose of the sedative ketamine, causing a heart attack. He never regained consciousness and died several days later. Elijah McClain was 23 years old. His case went unnoticed until the racial reckoning following the police killing of George Floyd in May 2020. Protests grew in Aurora, a Denver suburb. Colorado Governor Jared Polis empowered the state attorney general to investigate. And in September, three police officers and two EMTs were charged with manslaughter, homicide, and assault. This week, Aurora reached an undisclosed settlement with the McClain family. A tectonic shift is underway in public awareness of the pervasiveness of police violence, especially directed at young Black men. There's also a growing willingness to prosecute police who kill. Yet, the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act died in the U.S. Senate. And just this week, the U.S. Supreme Court made it harder to hold police accountable with two opinions that strengthen the doctrine of qualified immunity. Despite the resistance of these powerful institutions, it will be an engaged citizenry, both documented and undocumented, that will end the epidemic of police killing. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Okay, I'm trying to monitor the CU Folk and Roots Festival at the same time. I'm getting a stream from the outdoor tent, and it's Jose Gobo and a flautist, Lees. So that's outside. It's a little cool, but it's hot guitar from Jose Gobo, Brazilian. I decided to reverse the order and get to the public citizen interview. It was plagued with technical difficulties. Maybe the Apple update that went on to my phone last night might have something to do with it. This is a bit of a punt, but I wanted to mention again that there's been this latency problem in the touch screen and other actions since the update that was generated by the revelations of the Pegasus spying system that goes way deep into the code of all Apple products, even your computer at home. And maybe it's a stretch, but there was some problem. I took out a lot of pauses, and so it's shorter now, so maybe we'll get it all on for once. But it's the short live part fixed up a little bit, and it's a very important issue on corporate power, big pharma, and how nobody's saying the unspoken, which is that the profits of the big companies is more important than actually getting the pandemic under control, it seems to me. So here's Natasha Leonard. I never heard an interview with her before. I've read her stuff on The Intercept. She seems to be from the UK or somewhere. Yeah, let's get to this. This is more thematically related to police enforcement, and this is about differential enforcement of the laws when the character, the political stance of the perp is different. I guess there was a major fine issued to two of the January 5th, a couple that were involved. I still have been arguing, sending it to news outlets on their Twitter feed that, and I actually contacted our junior senator since she seemed to be interested in the issue of rooting out white supremacist and anti-democratic forces in the military, since she's a vet. I'm having an aphasia on her name again, but why not reactivate the vets that were in the wrong there? and try them in military courts. It would relieve the overburdened D.C. courts. Okay, here's, I forget who the interviewer is actually at this point. This is from Rising Up with Sonali, so it's actually Sonali Kolhatkar interviewing. It's not from an intercepted piece. This is her theme, and I thought I only had a little bit of it. She's doing a weekly program now. She was daily.
This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Federal prosecutions of January 6th rioters continue as participants in the deadly action at the Capitol face prosecutions and convictions. A House panel investigating the attack is also reportedly readying a charge of criminal contempt against Donald Trump's former advisor, Steve Bannon, over his refusal to comply with a subpoena over the probe. But strong as the response to the January 6th riot sounds, there has been little attention paid to a non-participant on the other side of the political spectrum who has received a harsher sentence than most rioters for doing little other than exercising his First Amendment rights. Daniel Baker, a self-described anarchist based in Florida, has been sentenced to 44 months in federal prison for calling for armed self-defense against gun-toting white supremacists. My guest is Natasha Leonard, columnist for The Intercept. Her work has appeared in The Nation, Book Forum, and The New York Times, among others. She teaches critical journalism at the New School for Social Research in New York, and she's the author of Being Numerous, Essays on Non-Fascist Life. She joins me now to discuss her latest article in The Intercept entitled, A Florida Anarchist Will Spend Years in Prison for Online Posts Prompted by the January 6th Riot. Welcome to the program, Natasha.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So first, let's talk about the fact that this person seemingly did absolutely nothing other than speak. He didn't go to Washington, D.C. on January 6th. So who is Daniel Baker and what is he actually accused of doing?
Right. So Daniel Baker is a Florida-based anarchist, as you say, also a yoga teacher, a practicing Hare Krishna, and is very involved in local community mutual aid down in Tallahassee. He was arrested just over a week after the January 6th riots. There was an FBI raid on his home because following January the 6th, he had taken to social media, particularly Facebook, and put out these, you know, really quite bellicose, I will say, and somewhat reckless given the political climate, calls to arms. But they were very, very general, not aimed at specific individuals, not, you know, planning any sort of specific January 6th counter events with any sort of timing, any sort of meetup points. But the idea was, as many people feared, including the FBI itself, that far-right groups, mobs, and militiae around the country would storm local state houses around Joe Biden's inauguration in sort of a swarm of follow-up copycat mini January the 6th. So Baker, who is on the left and very much has committed much of his life to countering far-right white supremacist ideologies and organizing, put out this call to say, no, you know, we should defend against these white supremacist mobs should they amass again. You know, we did not in fact see huge follow-ups to January 6th, in large part because there was a lot of, you know, formal law enforcement backup brought into local state houses. But certainly Baker's concern about more January 6th to come were not in and of themselves rare. In fact, they were common. But he was charged and then convicted of sending interstate threats by virtue of making these kind of very vague, although quite aggressive, online statements. I don't think there's a reasonable way that these statements, however reckless they were, could be read as genuine threats worthy of 44 months in prison, consider the fact, as I mentioned in my article, that a man from Georgia who had driven across state lines with guns and ammo in tow to attend January 6th had missed the riot because of car trouble, but was sending texts saying, "I'm going to shoot Nancy Pelosi in the head," and had in fact traveled across state lines with guns, received a considerably shorter sentence for the same charge, interstate threats. Baker did not in fact name anyone as a target, never attended any sort of event, did not go towards the Tallahassee State House with a gun, did not in fact gather individuals together in some sort of anti-fascist group. So just as a point of law, these this unequal false equivalence and in fact further persecution of the left-wing anti-fascist protester who did not in fact even attend a protest is notable. And you know, that's not even to speak of the fact that our judicial system would of course not consider that there should be no moral equivalence drawn between fascist organizing and the anti-fascists who might want to organize against them, for example, Baker.
Right. I mean, it's quite remarkable that we see, especially during the Trump years, so many white supremacists so openly calling for things like armed self-defense, really skirting the line around incitement of violence, even before the January 6th riot, you know, something that might have been far worse than what Daniel Baker called for, would have been shrugged off and accepted as, well, it's their Second Amendment right, right?
Yeah, I mean, it should have been a pretty straightforward First Amendment protected case. And as you say, yes, it's hardly rare that on from the far right, we see constant overtures online to armed overturning of the Biden result, to armed revolution, you know, in defense of white standing. It's very, very common, you know, and Baker's, I actually, you know, I personally don't have a problem with physically confronting fascists. And I've written at length about why that's often, in fact, a kind of a well-informed and philosophically well-informed approach to fascist mobs and fascist organizing, actual physical confrontation. But more to the point in terms of Baker's case, whether I think there are moral justifications for physically confronting fascists or not, it shouldn't even matter because no such confrontations took place. All Baker was doing was, as you say, engaging in what should be protected speech. This was by no reasonable standard could be understood as a direct threat. No given person was threatened.
So this is a man who was held for, you point out, 10 grueling months during his trial, 7 of which were in solitary confinement, and now he's sentenced to 44 months in prison. It seems as though he has been, he's being made a scapegoat of. Did you get a chance to communicate with him in writing about his story? I mean, I really haven't seen the story anywhere else.
Yes, so I was one of his friends in who was part of his support committee actually reached out to me to let me know about the story. So then I looked into it, and some articles were written at the time of his arrest, at the time of the FBI raid. And there was a good piece in Jacobin actually that pointed out that his prosecution is, or you know, already evidence come to fruition that we don't want the kind of rubric of counter-terror to be totally embraced by the government as if that's the way we're going to kill white supremacy in this country, by embracing a state apparatus counter-terror program that of course inevitably will cause further harm for the left and for Black liberation struggle and other kind of social justice movements that aren't white supremacists, such as the history of state counter-terror. So that was noted at the time of his arrest, but then really nothing was said about him aside from in hyper-local press. And then when his sentencing was coming up, and then, you know, we discovered how much longer it would be than a lot of the what one could call charge-wise comparable January 6th cases, it seemed worth drawing attention to. So I had been in touch with his support committee and his attorneys, and then also spoke to him a number of times on the phone. He was allowed 15-minute calls from federal prison and via the kind of prison email system calling. So we did, we were in pretty regular contact while I was reporting the story. And he told me some pretty harrowing things that are also part of a lawsuit he has filed against the Bureau of Prisons for his treatment. For example, when he was held in solitary in the special housing unit SHU, he was cycled around cells that would consistently be covered in feces because an incarcerated person next to him, a gentleman, had been held for 2 years, considered mentally unfit for trial, had clear severe mental illness. Baker later found out by contacting the man's family that he was autistic and that the prison was not making accommodations for that in any way. So this you know, very, very disturbed man was, you know, covering his cell with feces and throwing his feces. And this was where Baker was placed during months of solitary confinement, again, for writing emails. And to be clear, I believe in prison abolition per se. It's not that I think, you know, only the January 6th people should go to prison and otherwise, you know, prisons are great aside from when it's for leftists. Like, obviously, incarceration is the problem here, but it is particularly striking given what Baker was charged for and convicted of.
Do you know if there's any efforts around a support group or a campaign for Baker or appealing his sentencing or anything that, you know, people who are listening to this, watching this interview might be feeling outraged and want to rally in support of him?
So he will be appealing his conviction, and that will be, you know, happening, that he will be starting to seek appeal immediately. There's not a specific fund, but if you look for Daniel Baker Tallahassee on Twitter, you will see that there are various links to his book wish list he wants to be reading while he's incarcerated, and you can send books to him via that wish list. You can do it in a way that accords with prison regulations around books received and whatnot. But yeah, there's not a specific fund right now, but I'm sure if you keep an eye on Daniel Baker Tallahassee, if you're on Twitter, and I will be keeping people abreast of what happens in the case and the appeal going forward.
Again, thank you so much, Natasha. We'll post a link to your article from our website, risingupatsonali.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
And if you want to look for that, it's Leonard, L-E-N-N-A-R-D, and it's up at The Intercept. Okay, it's almost half past already. A lot of things came up in that. Now we're going to go to the Democracy Now! Parts 1 and 2. Again, Public Citizen. For some reason, there were a lot of problems with their audio. Hopefully they'll get a better connection in the future. But they did fix the part two interview up. This is obviously close to me because I penned an article about the WTO, the vaccine, and Moderna mentioned explicitly. This has stuff about Moderna that's just revolting. I want to caveat that there was a flaw in the editing of my article, and it turned the thesis in 180 degrees. What I was arguing is that there's already a law in the book. It's called the Bayh-Dole Act. Yeah, those guys that allowed for the privatization of profits by pharmaceutical companies of government research. It actually also has a provision which, as far as I can tell, has never been used, that the government can, and I use the word, enjoin them to license. Enjoined is typically used to stop something from happening, but you can also enjoin a corporation to license. And if they were doing that, the production hub that WHO was setting up in South Africa wouldn't have to be trying to replicate the mRNA vaccine. They would have the secrets to actually having a response to the
pandemic that would actually maybe stop us from having Lambda through Omega variants in the future. Half past opinions you hear are those of the speakers. Radio Free Labor coming up. I'm sure that'll be a packed show. There's a lot going on with middle of Striketober or something like that. All right, here's Amy Goodman. I don't know if I included a theme or I cut straight to the chase. I hope I cut straight to the chase.
DemocracyNow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We look now at how one of the leading COVID-19 vaccine makers appears to have restricted access to those very vaccines. The People's Vaccine Alliance says just 14% of the 1.8 billion doses rich nations promised to donate have been delivered so far. And this week, Germany said it expected to miss its target to donate 100 million doses this year, due in part to legal restrictions imposed by vaccine manufacturers. Some of these restrictions are detailed in a new damning report by the consumer group Public Citizen called Pfizer's Power that looks at Pfizer's contracts with the United States, United Kingdom, European Commission, Albania, Brazil, Colombia, Chile, Dominican Republic, and Peru. They offer a rare glimpse into the power Pfizer has to silence governments, throttle supply, shift risk, and maximize profits in the middle of a global public health crisis. For more, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Zane Rizvi, law and policy researcher for Public Citizen, author of this new report. Find out, lay out for us your findings, Zane.
We are in the worst public health crisis in over a century, and Pfizer has used its monopoly over a life-saving vaccine, a remarkable vaccine, to extract really concerning concessions from desperate governments around the world. And so we detail six examples. And I should say that the contracts are mostly the same, but there are variations within each contract. But almost all the contracts contain, for example, a provision that allows Pfizer to control, essentially, what is said about the contracts. Almost all the contracts contain a provision that says if there is a vaccine shortage, then Pfizer gets to unilaterally decide what the priority of deliveries is, and the countries will simply accept those terms. There's provisions about donations, and Pfizer gets to say whether a country can either donate a Pfizer vaccine or even accept a donated Pfizer vaccine. And so there's just all kinds of things in these contracts.
They cannot take donated vaccine. You have countries that are dealing, in the Western world, even if there are issues of vaccine hesitancy, the majority of people have been vaccinated. You have countries where we're talking about in the single digits. Can you talk more about this, that they're not allowed to accept donated vaccines? We're talking to Zane Rizvi, law and policy researcher for Public Citizen. He's author of the new report, Pfizer's Power. It is a very important report on how Pfizer has silenced governments while maximizing profits during the pandemic. It goes on to talk about the Brazilian government accepting a contract with Pfizer that contains most of the same terms that the government once deemed unfair. Brazil waived sovereign immunity, imposed no penalties on Pfizer for late deliveries, agreed to resolve disputes under a secret private arbitration under the laws of New York, and broadly indemnified Pfizer for civil claims. Brazil's contract says it can't make any public announcement concerning the existence, subject matter, or terms of the agreement, or comment on its relationship with Pfizer without Pfizer's prior written consent. It sounds like Pfizer's far more powerful, Zane, than any of these countries.
And that's the tragedy here, right? That governments around the world have propped up Pfizer by awarding government-granted monopolies and enabling a system of international intellectual property protection that empowers Pfizer. And so you have Pfizer becoming king, in a sense. And that is outrageous in this pandemic.
conversation about Pfizer's power. That's the name of a damning new report by the consumer group Public Citizen that looks at how Pfizer's tried to silence governments, throttle supply, shift risk, and maximize profits in the middle of a global public health crisis. We're continuing our conversation with Zane Rizvi, law and policy researcher for Public Citizen, author of this new report. So, Zane, if you can talk about the power of Pfizer. And then we're going to go on to Moderna. But we are talking about massive pharmaceutical companies who that have made billions with the support of public funding.
Pfizer is expected to make $30 billion this year from the COVID vaccine alone. It's going to be the highest grossing pharmaceutical product in the history of pharmaceuticals on a yearly basis. And Pfizer has a monopoly on this life-saving vaccine. And so it has gone around the world extracting concessions from desperate countries. And so we see developing countries trying to push back, trying to fight back, but then having really no choice. And the people who could control Pfizer, the governments who have the leverage, the power, have simply not stepped up.
So let's talk specifically. Let's continue our discussion about Brazil. Tell us everything you know about the contract between Pfizer and Brazil. And we should let people know that part of the deal is that Brazil will not reveal these contracts.
So Brazil was one of the first and only countries to really speak out publicly about Pfizer's negotiation tactics. Way back in January, Brazil complained publicly that what Pfizer was demanding was abusive and unfair. And yet, within 2 months, Brazil was back at the negotiating table with Pfizer and ended up signing a deal for $1 billion that largely contained those same unfair and abusive terms. And so it really shows the desperation of countries like Brazil when they need to get access to vaccine. And one condition was added, actually, to the Brazilian contract that we have not seen in the other contracts. So Brazil cannot speak about the contract, cannot even speak about its relationship with Pfizer without the consent of the company. And so you have a situation in which one of the few countries which was outspoken in the beginning now has to go through Pfizer to talk about the contract. And that's not the only egregious provision in the contract. Brazil can also not accept donated Pfizer doses or even donate Pfizer doses without the permission of the company itself.
But now, and talk about the reasons for this. I mean, cannot accept in a time of a pandemic when you want to get as much as you can possibly get so that your population will survive. They cannot get donated vaccines if Pfizer doesn't want them to?
Pfizer says that these provisions are designed to, you know, they're mutually agreed. They are designed for purposes relating to liability, to making sure that Pfizer can keep track of, you know, where doses are belong where. But it's not hard to see how those very same provisions are deeply problematic and can be used in all kinds of really concerning ways. We've actually seen the European Commission, for example, getting lobbied by the German government, who is now saying that some of the contracts that they've entered into with these pharmaceutical companies are just restricting the equitable distribution of vaccines around the world. And so they need to ramp up the pressure on these companies.
Okay. Can you talk about Pfizer securing an IP waiver, Zane?
So the head of Pfizer for a long time has ridiculed and mocked efforts to secure an intellectual property waiver at the World Trade Organization, to freely share the vaccine recipe with the World Health Organization. And, you know, opponents of this often claim that IP does not matter. And yet when you look into the contracts, you see that Pfizer is well aware of the risks of intellectual property. And so if Pfizer gets sued, for example, in Colombia over patent infringement, Colombia will be required to foot the bill. Pfizer can require Colombia to take control of the legal proceedings and defend the company as well. And so in a sense, you are seeing how Pfizer gets an IP waiver. Pfizer can use anyone's intellectual property it pleases, but that same reciprocity is not built in.
Zane, you say in your report that Pfizer's demands have been slowing purchase agreements and even pushing back the delivery schedules of vaccines. I mean, we're not talking about a delivery of dresses here. We're talking about a delivery of life over death. What does this mean?
It's outrageous. It really is a stunning indictment of our international intellectual property system that empowers these corporations to make these kinds of decisions. No one corporation should be able to decide whether a sovereign government gets access to a life-saving vaccine in the middle of a pandemic. And so we have, for example, the Philippines and in South Africa, these negotiations between Pfizer and the countries went on for weeks. And the governments initially resisted. And as a result of those intense negotiations, the contract took longer to sign. And because the contracts took longer to sign, the eventual delivery of vaccines was also much slower.
So you also say Pfizer can also go after state assets, that the U.S. government in particular can exercise the leverage it holds over Pfizer to require a better approach, empowering multiple manufacturers to produce the vaccine via technology transfer, and a TRIPS waiver can rein in Pfizer's power. Explain what that all means.
What it means is that we have created a system about 25 years ago that requires governments around the world to award monopolies to corporations over life-saving technologies like vaccines in a pandemic. And that system is not working. And so what we need is governments with power, governments like the United States, to really step up and to tell Pfizer that what you are doing is unacceptable, and that we are going to limit that power by empowering other manufacturers. And so, for example, the Biden administration can use the Defense Production Act to require Pfizer to share the vaccine recipe. Sharing the vaccine recipe could help other manufacturers around the world start ramping up production of the Pfizer vaccine, start ramping up production of this life-saving technology. And so, in a way, it takes that power away from Pfizer that allows it to go around the world and demand these kinds of conditions.
Can you talk about the profit that Pfizer has made? And, you know, a lot is made of, you have Moderna that got massive infusion of funds. We'll talk about that in a minute. But that Pfizer, I think the CEO Bourla said, who clearly despised Trump, we never took a penny to develop this. But that isn't true.
These are narrow distinctions that are made by corporate CEOs. But the reality is that if the Pfizer vaccine was authorized by the FDA, Pfizer was getting a huge upfront payment from the U.S. government no matter what. It was going to be about $2 billion. And so the U.S. government de-risked some of the Pfizer vaccine. And it's also fundamentally true that the Pfizer vaccine is actually built on technology that was funded by the National Institutes of Health, in some cases was developed by the National Institutes of Health. And so the fact that we have these amazing vaccines is actually a testament to the work of publicly funded scientists over decades, actually. And so there is no such thing as the Pfizer vaccine if there was no public investment in this kind of science from many years ago.
So let's talk about how the other major COVID mRNA vaccine maker, Moderna, faces growing pressure to share its vaccine recipe. The WHO, the World Health Organization, hired an African startup to try to figure out how to make one that's as close as possible. Last week, several U.S. Democratic lawmakers sent a letter noting Moderna got a massive infusion of U.S. taxpayer funds to help develop the vaccine, including at least $1 billion just for research. The former scientific head of the U.S. COVID-19 vaccine response said the government, quote, held Moderna by the hand on a daily basis. The letter argued the Biden administration should use language in the government's contracts with Moderna to force the company to divulge its process. So explain what that would mean.
Moderna is the story of a company that has benefited from U.S. public investment every step of the way. The company's name, Moderna, is based on modified RNA. Modified RNA is a technology that was funded by the National Institutes of Health. And that's where the story starts, right? Like 10 years ago. In this case, Moderna literally invented the vaccine in partnership with the National Institutes of Health. This is Tony Fauci's team. Tony Fauci's team was there helping Moderna invent the vaccine. And then another U.S. government agency, BARDA, put in a massive infusion of funding, more than $1 billion to scale up manufacturing and to help with research and development. And so as part of this contract, we found a provision that says that the U.S. government has unlimited rights to share data funded under the contract. And we think this appears to cover key manufacturing information. And so if the U.S. government were to exercise these unlimited rights in conjunction with the Defense Production Act, we think the U.S. government could share the vaccine recipe, could help the African scientists who are trying to make the Moderna vaccine in the WHO hub right now, and really help scale up global production all around the world and bring bring the pandemic to a quicker end.
Finally, Zain Rizvi, what would be most important? What is the most important part of bringing this to a global end? What needs to happen?
Look, there's three things. One, we need to immediately share the doses that we have that are excess doses. It's unconscionable if there are wasted doses in the U.S. as millions of people around the world haven't gotten a single shot. The second thing is we need to share the vaccine recipe. We need to quickly waive intellectual property rights at the World Trade Organization. And then finally, we need to make surge investments in global vaccine manufacturing capacity. Congress has allocated $2 billion in a markup by the House Energy and Commerce Committee, but we need to make sure that that remains in the Build Back Better package. And so we need Senator Schumer to ensure that there is funding for global vaccine manufacturing.
Would you say that campaign contributions make a big difference in how senators and Congress members relate to the companies that are making these vaccines?
It's the lobbying, it's the mirage of AstroTurf groups. But the people are with us. You know, if you look at Americans' support for global vaccine manufacturing, for increased global vaccine donation, you consistently see that Americans understand that no one is safe until everyone is safe.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Zain Rizvi, law and policy researcher for Public Citizen. We will link to your report, Pfizer's Power. To see part one of our discussion, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
That was part two, a web exclusive, not aired in the usual slot for the Democracy Now. Excellent. Except he didn't say the name of Baidol, the contract language. He went back to the WTO. The U.S. does not need the WTO TRIPS waiver. It can enjoin Moderna to share and license. They would get money on it, but they want to keep their golden goose, their golden egg or something, whatever appropriate is. All right, I mentioned I wanted to go to the border with Camilo Bustillo. Only have a time to get a few minutes of a longer segment from Flashpoints from this week. Forget what day. There's a really amazing interview, a new book by Carl Grossman, go-to guy on nuclear issues of energy and weapons, talking about the Cold War in Long Island. And a story about Plum Island off of Long Island, which was another Fort Detrick, basically, a base where, I want to play a little excerpt of that, but I want to play a lot of things. So share this. You can go to flashpoints.net. If you know anybody that has Lyme disease, a law was just passed under the radar. It was put forward by a Republican congressperson from that district, Long Island and Plum Island, suggesting that they need to study whether the weaponization of ticks was studied at Plum Island in the decades past and may have unleashed Lyme disease in some way. I don't know the substance of it, as I don't know the Wuhan story. It seems to be getting more complicated. There were some revelations this week that there was some study of the coronavirus to see if you could make it more transmissible. I think the rationale would be to study how you react to that, but not a weaponization plan, but to study the dynamics of it, how mutations happen. So, but it's being bandied about, and I haven't delved into it. The Intercepted did some things about both that and the monetization of ivermectin and other snake oil solutions to COVID. I think I'm getting a booster this week, actually, despite the fact that I've been haranguing about, I don't want them to be wasted here, that's for sure. My article on the web is corrected, so if you want to look for what I wrote about the WTO charade, I also was making a note to my mind when I was playing the bit about scapegoating and the differential punishment of protesters depending on their political stance. There's an excellent series of articles in The Public Eye by Janice Jays, and there will be, it's about the, hung on the Shamar Betz marketplace uprising, whatever it was called, riot, last year. And excellent stuff. It's going to come up at the Friday Forum. In fact, the last Friday Forum is going to have a discussion of this local case. If you haven't heard about it, or you've read about it in the News Gazette, go to the Public Eye and find Janice Jay's articles. So, okay, I shot another couple of minutes, so we're going to just hear, you can go and hear the entirety of this 21, 22-minute program. He was talking about it, and he may mention it in the segment. Haymarket was going to do a thing about Haitian, a webinar kind of thing. I think it's canceled or postponed. I think maybe one of the Haitians couldn't make it or something. Carmen Bastillo was going to make it. Thanks for tuning in. Radio Free Labor coming up in just 9 minutes. Somebody will show up shortly, I'm sure.
Joining us again, and we're happy to have him back, is Camilo Perez Bustillo. He's in Taipei. He's the now visiting professor of human rights and social justice at the National Taiwan University College of Law. Camilo Perez Bustillo, it's been too long. Welcome back. You want to just start with a general look at how that appears to you? You've got the whole world's attention on those kidnapped victims in Haiti, the missionaries. And you've got a systematic program by the United States government of kidnapping, cuffed into planes and taken back to Haiti to be set loose in front of the death squads.
Thanks, Dennis. It's an honor to be back. I think, you know, what's striking, especially is, you know, the attention in the U.S. is drawn to Colin Powell and his legacy and what that means. What's getting lost in the conversation is the ways in which you have basically secular saints lifted up, like Colin Powell, who somehow represents a success story. And you have the Haitians and Black immigrants who are the victims of systematic brutality left off to one side. And so I think that contrast is really sharp as we speak. The important thing is this. We have a powerful new national coalition that's emerged in the wake of the images we all saw of Haitian migrants being whipped and corralled by Border Patrol agents on horseback at Del Rio, at the border, a coalition led by the Haitian Bridge Alliance, by the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, by the Undocumented Black Network, and many other local, regional, and national organizations focused on the rights of Black immigrants, plus allies from communities throughout the country. There were dozens of actions on a National Day of Action on October 14th, another wave of actions and initiatives between October 11th and 17th. Even as we speak, there's a complementary initiative led by the Cameroon Advocacy Network, specifically pressing for that sector, often forgotten, of African immigrants, in this case specifically from the English-speaking sectors of Cameroon, fighting for asylum and for temporary protected status. You've got a major article in the New York Times that just came out highlighting that after Del Rio, after those images, after what we've seen with Haitian migrants, the entire question of the mistreatment, the racist and xenophobic abuses against Black immigrants is at the center of the conversation. But we have to be absolutely vigilant and insistent that this continue to be at the center of the discussion. What just happened, the expulsion of over 8,000 Haitian migrants singled out for this abuse by the U.S., another 2,000 deported from other Caribbean countries, sadly including Cuba and the Bahamas. What this tells us is that this is the largest mass expulsion of migrants of any single group since the 1950s, since what was officially called Operation Wetback in 1954, and it cannot happen again.
It cannot happen again. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That is the voice of Camilo Perez Bustillo. He's been a longtime fighter for humane and a transformation in immigration policy. It only gets worse and worse, though. Here we have a Democrat, and the comparison is stark. You can't help but recognize the fact that this guy in the White House, when it comes to this issue, is either clueless or absolutely brutal in his continued enforcement of Article 42, which gives the Biden administration, which gave the Trump administration, and you know how it goes, unbelievable powers of deportation to essentially circumvent thoroughly and fully anything that was left of the asylum process. This is a very difficult moment in this history. I am glad to hear that there's a lot happening, a lot of organizing, and it's necessary.
You know, the key thing is that they got away with it this time, but we are going to continue to hold them accountable. It's crucial for the Biden administration to continue to be assessed from this perspective, through this filter. What was done to Haitian migrants historically as the worst mass deportation in over 50 years, in over 60 years. But not only that, the policies that continue to unfold that you've just alluded to at the border as we speak, against Haitians, but against every single other migrant from anywhere in the world who shows up at the border and seeks asylum, is summarily denied and sent back. You know, we have the data that we shared with you, Dennis, about over 1 million migrants who've been expelled by the U.S. pursuant to Title 42 since it was imposed by Trump, by the Trump administration at the beginning of the pandemic in March 2020. And the Biden administration has doubled down and is defending several major cases that have been brought against Title 42. They are defending Title 42 in federal court. And not only that, in the last few days, they've begun to reactivate the so-called Remain in Mexico program, which means that migrants are forced to remain on Mexican territory to await processing in dangerous and precarious conditions that have been denounced by humanitarian organizations from throughout the world and that we witnessed at the border at the beginning of the pandemic. And so what we're talking about now is in those two key domains, asylum and the Remain in Mexico policy, the Biden administration's approach is exactly the same as the one that was pursued by the Trump administration. That's the message that has to be hammered home.
Camilo Bustillo. He has a hyphenated name. I can't remember the other one. He's professor of law and he's human rights professor in Taipei, Taiwan. He's with Witness at the Border on Facebook. They also have a web page if you're in the more old school. That was from flashpoints.net. You can find it. Again, that Carl Grossman piece is engrossing as well about Long Island, Plum Island, the weaponization of ticks. There's actually a bill passed to investigate that. Anyway, amazing stuff. It's time for me to play an underwriting announcement, get out of here, and give away to the two guys. It's a dynamic duo today. Hope Stephanie's doing well. And my name is Paul Muth. When opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. Folk and roots all day. Son Monarcos are hitting it right away. I think I'm going to go say hi. They're doing a set later today, too. I can't seem to move.
Campaign Center partnership who foster a vibrant, inviting, and active core downtown, midtown, and campus town by strengthening businesses and building community. CCP's vision is to create healthy and vibrant micro-urban areas for residents and visitors through marketing, advocacy, and special events. CCP encourages and educates the public to shop locally throughout the year. Local businesses need your help more than ever. When you spend $100 at a locally owned business, $68 out of that $100 stays right here in our community. For more information about the Champaign Center Partnership, visit them on their website at champaigncenter.com, or you can give them a call at 217-